This is Jim Engster. Today is November 22nd, 2013, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy in Dallas. We'll talk with Richard Lipsey. He served in the U.S. Army from 1962 to 64. He was an aide to the top general for President Kennedy and was present at the autopsy of the president and at his funeral. We'll discuss then and now with Richard Lipsey. Also, Vincent Bugliosi, the famed prosecutor, the man who put Charlie Manson behind bars, who has written perhaps the definitive work about the Kennedy assassination. He concludes that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman 50 years ago today. His book, Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John Kennedy a few years ago. We'll find out from him whether his mind has been changed. Now the news. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Your number outside our area, it's 877-217-5757. Engster Show at WRKF.org online. We're with Richard Lipsey. He was a U.S. soldier. Lieutenant Lipsey was assigned to the President of the United States, a man from Baton Rouge who went to Washington, and in his first day on the job, he's in the Oval Office, and today he is with us on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. Like today, it was a Friday, Dallas, Texas. Half century ago, most Americans were not alive when this event occurred, which some believe is the biggest event of the second half of the 20th century, and it certainly has changed the fabric of this country. No matter what your political persuasion is, I think most people would concur with that. Good morning, Richard Lipsey.
Good morning, Jim. Pleasure to be here.
Well, as I stated, your ride to the White House was an unusual one. Here's this kid from Baton Rouge who suddenly is in the Oval Office meeting the President of the United States at the age of 23. How did that occur?
It really was. I was stationed at Fort Polk, Louisiana, then Camp Polk, and a new general came aboard. The reservists were there, and we came in as the regular army. And when the new general came in, I was fortunate enough to be asked to give him a tour of the post, and I did. Later that evening, he called me over to meet his family and asked me if I would like to be an aide to him. And I really was not sure what the duties of an aide, general's aide, was at the time, but it turned out to be great because just a few months later, General Wheel, Philip Wheel, was transferred to the Military District of Washington to take it over and took me with him to Washington.
And you go to Washington and you're, I guess, walking to the White House and you go right to the Oval Office. Now, I've been to the White House. I've talked to one president, but I've never been in the Oval Office. You were there for your first day on the job.
Well, that's exactly right. We went to meet the chief of staff when we got to Washington, and he told us that, you know, General Wheel's duties, which would include all official ceremonies in Washington, state funerals, visiting dignitaries, the defense of Washington, all of that, and that it was very important that General Wheel meet the president. So he sent us to the White House. We walked into the Oval Office, and President Kennedy came from around his desk, shook hands with both General Wheel and myself, and there was a small table and two little settees around it. And the general and President Kennedy sat on each side, and President Kennedy looked at me and said, "Lieutenant, why don't you just sit right there in my rocking chair?" And so, you know, the famous pictures of all of his rocking chairs. So during their very short, about a 20-minute conversation, I rocked in President Kennedy's rocking chair.
At the age of 23. And he was young, too. He was 45. Were you impressed with him?
I was extremely impressed. Like you said earlier, regardless of your political persuasion, the man was very, very smart. He was a very forward thinker. He had vision that our country has not seen in a long time. He knew where we should be, where we should be going, not where we had been. You know, he was interested in what writers and painters and artists were thinking. He was really a very intelligent person, speed reader.
Yeah, when you would hand him these documents, I would imagine he looked at them briefly. And
when I
he
would
had it.
Go back to his office, which was frequently, to brief him on people coming to the White House, he could go through 60, 70, 80 pages in a couple of minutes at the most and had a perfect photographic memory. He would know everything in that briefing. Amazing man, he really was.
He was a captivating physical presence, too.
Well, he was. He always stood erect, and, you know, you hear about all of his back problems and his different things that were wrong with the president. But he never, ever had any emotion on his face like most of us do when our back hurts, we slump over, or we complain. You never, ever heard a word from the president's mouth about that. He was a perfect specimen. And, of course, I picked him up out with a couple of technicians out of his coffin when we got to the Bethesda Naval Hospital and laid him on the morgue table to do the autopsy. There was not an ounce of fat on him. A very perfect physical specimen.
At 46. And you have noted this was the first dead body you had ever seen.
First dead person I had ever seen. But you get wrapped up in the emotion of the event. It's like, you know, one of the out-of-body experiences. We had a job to do. General Wheel assigned me that from the moment that the president's coffin, the body, arrived in Washington at Andrews Air Force Base, that I was not to leave it and to guard that. And we got it to the hospital, and General Wheel went upstairs with Jackie Kennedy to the presidential suite to really start planning the funeral. I mean, she had already sent word, although that's one of General Wheel's official duties, and we had a book probably 12 inches thick. Remember, President Eisenhower was still alive. Harry Truman was still alive. Both were quite elderly. So we're pretty up to date on what to do in case of a presidential funeral, state funeral. We had no idea, obviously, anything like this would ever happen. But we were prepared, and when we got that body to the hospital, I went in the morgue with it and did not leave it until the autopsy was over, and went back in after we changed clothes, went back in when Gawler's funeral home were there to put the body back together, basically dress the body, embalm him. And so from basically about 7 o'clock that evening with about a 45-minute break until 4 o'clock in the morning, I was in that autopsy room.
Were you the only soldier who witnessed the autopsy?
I was the only soldier that witnessed the entire autopsy, other than the doctors, of course. There were two and many times three doctors in the room. When we first put the body up on the table, the technicians came in and took photographs and x-rays and prepared the body for the autopsy, and I helped them in that part. And then the room was basically sealed. It was not like the JFK movie that Irving Stone did.
Oliver Stone.
I'm sorry, okay. That Oliver Stone did, where the scene was chaos in the room during the autopsy. There was no chaos in the room. It was quiet, very attentive. The doctors tended to their business. And so it wasn't like the movie at all.
Well, you were standing there. You saw the president. We've seen some of those autopsy photos since. As you say, he was even a handsome man in death and young, 46 years old at the time. You had been with him for a year. I'm sure had met with him probably 100 times or so during the course of that year, became friendly with him, as friendly as a young man who's a soldier serving the president can be. What was your emotion when you saw him in that condition?
The first impression, well, of course, you have to go back to noon that day, 1:30. We picked General Wheel up in the morning real early, 6:30 in the morning. We go to our office. We lived at Fort Myer, Virginia. That's where all the general wrote is, where all the generals lived. I was in a BOQ right across from the general's home, living in a very nice BOQ right above Maxwell Taylor, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Picked General Wheel up, went to our office, which is at Fort McNair, Virginia, in Washington, not too far from the White House. We brought General Wheel home about noon for lunch. I had lunch, and then our driver, whose name was Sergeant Humphrey, and I were sitting in the car listening to the radio outside of General Wheel's house at 1:30 Washington time.
Right.
And the news broadcast came on, the president's been shot. And that's all I heard. And I jumped out of the car, ran towards the general's house. The general came out of the house at the same time. Did you hear the news? Yes. And it was gripped with emotion. I was, the general was. We got in the car, headed towards the White House. Before we could get out of Fort Myer, Virginia, we had a red phone in our car, which had never rung, ever. And it's one of those direct lines. It was not in those, like today with a cell phone. It was one of those operator-type deals. But this phone rings, picked it up, and it was the White House ordering General Wheel to come directly to the White House. And through traffic and people standing there crying in the streets, having to go the wrong way on one-way streets and get up on curbs to get around the traffic, we got to the White House very quickly. And, of course, by then, we were listening to the radio. By then, it had come across that the president, you know, had been shot. The president was dead. So when we got to the White House, there was not much we could do. Everyone was standing around, very emotional, crying. No one really knew what the next step was. They were waiting for news from Dallas. So the chief of protocol was there and advised that we should go immediately to our office and start planning the funeral. And, of course, General Wheel had called and talked to our office. So when we got there at our office, we already had members of every armed service, the Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, Army, were all there. The Washington police, even members of the FBI and Secret Service were all already gathered and to start making plans on what to do when that body got back to Washington.
Well, you were there for the autopsy, and some of the conspiracy theorists have said that the autopsy was bungled. What did you see?
That's really not true, Jim. You know, I've gone back and read lots of notes and lots of books and the things that have been published, and I don't think it was. At the time, and I did not even find this out myself until years later, that they had done a tracheotomy in Dallas to try to save the president's life, which at that point had been kind of a waste, but they did. And they didn't inform the doctors in Washington that they had done a tracheotomy. And so there was a small wound at the bottom of his throat and the other wounds, you know, from the gunshot. And so they did a complete autopsy, and I won't go into certainly those details, but to examine the body, to find every fragment of bullet, to see what damage was done to the president. And it was not bungled. It was a good autopsy. Years later, I was privy to an FBI report that outlined the discussions with the FBI with the doctors immediately after the autopsy.
297-5633, your number. We'll return with Richard Lipsey after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Richard Lipsey, Lieutenant Richard Lipsey at the time, on this date in 1963, spent the evening hours presiding over an autopsy of the President of the United States, a man he had come to know well in the preceding year as the soldier assigned to the President at the White House. Richard Lipsey, the pride of Baton Rouge, rubbed shoulders with John Kennedy, who was, if anything describes it, American royalty. And he was killed much too young, 46 years old, on this date, November 22nd, Friday, 1963, Dealey Plaza, Dallas, Texas. Richard Lipsey was at the autopsy, and you have debunked, through your own personal knowledge, some of the conspiracy theories about chaos in the room, but you have come to the conclusion that Oswald acted alone. Why so?
The evidence, in my opinion, supports that. Of course, having watched the autopsy and watched the doctors carefully look at the wounds, the entrance and the exit wounds, the fragments of the bullets, the direction they came from, the number of bullets, all pointed to one shooter. And so while during the autopsy there was no discussion of Lee Harvey Oswald or, you know, who the shooter was, the determination was where he was shot, how many times he was shot, et cetera, et cetera. And then you look at Lee Harvey Oswald. You have this fellow, I think his name was Howard Brennan, that saw a young man in the school book depository, sixth floor, deliberately take aim and shoot the president. And immediately the police, as soon as he found a policeman and told them about it, the police rushed toward the school book depository. In the meantime, Lee Harvey Oswald exits, come down from the sixth floor, goes through the main hall of the school book depository. Two or three people see him rush out. Within 15 to 30 seconds after that, the police come in and seal the building. They take inventory of every person in the building. The only employee of the school book depository that is not there is Lee Harvey Oswald. And then you go back and you look where much before Lee Harvey Oswald, and these were the days you could buy a gun via mail order. And he had ordered the 6.5 Carcana and via mail under an alias that he commonly used. He had the gun. He had plenty of time to practice. He was had been in the Marine Corps, and, you know, he got kicked out and went to Russia, and he was in Russia and, you know, was a misfit there, and went to Cuba, and he was a misfit there. He was always trying to ingratiate himself on a group or influence a group or show his power, but it didn't work. He went to New Orleans and never, you know, tried to get in with the mafia and tried to get in with, you know, the Clay Shaw deal and all of the people there, and that really didn't work. He went to Dallas. So in my mind, he was out to prove that he could do this to the people and that he did not need any of these groups. He was going to show all of them. And if you think about it, they did not announce the president's that he was going to Texas until 4 days before. So where did, you know, I think this was an act of a spur of the moment. He didn't order that gun 6 months before, thinking he was going to shoot the president of the United States. This was a spur-of-the-moment thing that came up. He found out the president was coming. The parade route was in the newspaper. Yet when he exited the building, if there had been a conspiracy, there was nobody waiting on him, nobody to rush him away. He went and got on a city bus that got stuck in traffic.
Well,
and took a cab home, and then, of course, we know what happened after that. But everything points to that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin, and I firmly believe that.
Well, we'll talk with Vincent Bugliosi as well about this, but there are those who believe, yeah, Oswald was one of the shooters, but there were others. You were a firearms expert. Largest distributor of firearms in the United States is the man I'm looking at right now. How do you explain how Kennedy's head jerks violently backward? Could he have been shot from behind and have that kind of reaction?
It's the Isaac Newton's theory. For every action, there's a reaction. And when you shoot a bullet into something and it exits, the object goes in the opposite direction, goes backwards. And that's exactly what happened to Kennedy. And it's no magic to it. And that's what happened.
So you believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, and I know you're passionate about this. Do you get upset when you hear various conspiracy theories, or do you just blow them off as people who are ignorant about this?
Jim, there have been, ever since Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, there have been conspiracy theorists that meet yearly to discuss, you know, who put John Wilkes Booth up to it. And every single year since John Kennedy has been assassinated, there's a convention with thousands of people that all have their conspiracy theories. And I don't know, I don't think you do or anyone really knows for a fact, you know, all of these rumors from Lyndon Johnson to Onassis to the mafia, to the FBI, to the Russians, who put Lee Harvey Oswald up to it. Nobody knows. And in 50 years, they've never been able to tie down anything to it. So it is all theory. And so people would like to figure it out, but they've never been able to. Why did Jack Ruby shoot Oswald? Did somebody put him up to it? I don't think so. I think he hung around the police station all the time. And I think he got tied up in the emotion of the whole thing and said, you know, I'm going to kill this guy. He was in the hospital for months, as you know, dying of cancer. And they've never been able to tie him to anyone. So I think it's all a matter of circumstance. I think Oswald acted alone.
Oswald acted alone, says Richard Lipsy. One thing is for sure, it changed the fabric of America. You were 24 then, so according to my math, you'll be 74 today if you're 50 years later. A remarkably resilient 74-year-old man is Richard Lipsy, but your life and the lives of everybody in this country and in this world change as a result of that. What do you think the impact of that day in Dallas 50 years ago today is on the country and the world as we know it today?
That's a very good question. I guess you could look back and say, where would the world be if John Kennedy had lived with his vision and foresight, wanting to land a man on the moon, wanted to tear down the Berlin Wall. I mean, he was a very forward-looking person. And so how would the world have changed if he would have had his 8 years in office? You know, it's all about the time and the circumstance. And we've been through Vietnam. We've been through Iraq and Iran and the Gulf War. And times have changed. I don't think we have the leadership in our country that we deserve. I can remember as a kid Democrats and Republicans arguing with each other, then all going out to dinner at night and having fun. And in the end, they all came to a consensus. And I think our country, there's too much divisiveness in our country today. And I think we need to bring our country together to work as one. And I worry about that, Jim. I worry about the future of our country. And I think that the impact of the assassination on Kennedy gives people something to relive, and the discussion about it will go on forever.
Lieutenant Richard Lipsey, and I hope he'll stay with us as we continue our discussion with Vincent Bugliosi. Vincent Bugliosi is a man who has followed this case quite closely, and good morning to you, Mr. Bugliosi.
Yes, is this Jim?
It is, and we were talking about you and reclaiming history. We interviewed you when you wrote this book a few years back.
Yes, yes. And Jim, can you turn up the volume?
Yes, we'll do our best. What do you think? You wrote compellingly that Oswald acted alone. Has your opinion changed, or is it the same?
Repeat that question again. I wrote compellingly that Oswald acted alone.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, the notion that Oswald acted alone encompasses two somewhat separate but related issues. The two issues are that Oswald killed Kennedy, and number two, did he act alone? Was there a conspiracy involved? You're going to have to turn up the volume, Jim.
Well, you're on the air. We're hearing you fine.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about the first issue, because when you talk about conspiracy, you're kind of presupposing that Oswald's involved on a lot of anti-conspiracy arguments. So let's briefly address ourselves to Oswald's alleged guilt. In Reclaiming History, Jim, I set forth 53 separate pieces of evidence that point irresistibly to Oswald's guilt. And under those circumstances, it's not even humanly possible for him to be innocent. Because of the nature of life, you may have one, two, three, and in extremely rare situations, even four things pointing towards your guilt, even though you're completely innocent. But you're not going to have 53 things. Let's briefly go over some of the evidence against Oswald. Oswald's rifle, a 6.5-millimeter Mannlicher Carcano rifle, was determined by firearms experts to be the murder weapon. After the shooting in Dealey Plaza, Oswald was the only worker at the Book Depository building who fled the building. 45 minutes later, Oswald shot and killed Officer J.D. Tippett of the Dallas Police Department when Tippett stopped him on the street to question him. A half hour later, at the Texas Theater, Oswald resisted arrest by pulling a gun on the arresting officer. When he was interrogated for 12 hours over a three-day period by the Dallas Police Department, Oswald told one lie after another, one provable lie after another, all of which show, of course, an unmistakable consciousness of guilt. I can say, Jim, that I'm not just satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt of Oswald's guilt, I'm satisfied beyond all doubt. Now, on the separate issue, separate but related issue of conspiracy, in Reclaiming History, again at the near the end of the book, I summarize 32 pieces of evidence which point away from the existence of a conspiracy. Let me just mention three right now, then if we have time, you can get into other questions you might want to ask me. We cannot ignore, although the conspiracy theorists would like to do it, they just brush it off, but we cannot ignore that the Warren Commission, the FBI, and the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigated this case in great depth. The FBI alone conducted 25,000 interviews, and all of them concluded that there was no credible evidence, let's underline the word credible, no credible evidence that the CIA or mob or any other group was behind the assassination. All they could find was unsupported allegations and naked speculation. I want to digress for one quick moment on this word credible. Let me show you how non-credible the conspiracy theorists are. Over the past 50 years, at one time or another, one or more conspiracy theorists have accused 42 groups, 82 assassins, and 214 people of being involved in the assassination. Let's also take cognizance of the fact that in life it's virtually impossible to keep a secret. I told a jury once, three people can keep a secret, but only if two are dead. And here, 50 years have gone by, Jim, and not one credible word or syllable has leaked out of a conspiracy. Why? Because there's nothing to leak out. It's all nonsense. Point number two. Let's assume that one of these groups decided to kill the president. I find that proposition prodigiously unlikely, but, you know, anything is possible in life. Oswald would have been one of the very, very last people on the face of this earth they would have gone to do their bidding for them. He was not an expert shot. He had a $12 mail order rifle, notoriously unreliable, extremely unstable. Jim, here's a guy that defects to the Soviet Union pre-Gorbachev, 1959, even today. Who in the world defects to Russia? He gets over there, desperately wants to become a Soviet citizen. He's an avowed Marxist. He's turned down. And what does he do? Well, he slashes his wrist, tries to commit suicide, ends up in a hospital. Just the type of person, Jim, that the CIA or mob would want to rely upon to commit the biggest murder in American history. Now, you realize, Jim, that I'm being sarcastic, but I'm making a point here. Final point. This is just 3 points among the 32. Again, let's assume that one of these groups decided to kill the president, and for whatever reason, they wanted Oswald to be their hitman. Let's see where that takes us. After Oswald shot Kennedy in Dealey Plaza and left the Book Depository building, if the CIA or mob had Oswald kill Kennedy for them, there would have been a car waiting for him outside the Book Depository building to drive him to his death. You know that would have happened. And yet we know that Oswald was out on the street with $13 in his pocket trying to flag down buses and cabs. And that fact all by itself tells, I think, any sensible person that he acted alone. I mean, even the presidential motorcade route that took the limousine beneath the sixth-floor window in the Book Depository building where Oswald was, that route was not finally determined until November the 18th, 4 days before the assassination. And I would ask you, Jim, what reasonable person would really believe that a conspiracy to assassinate the President of the United States would be hatched within just 4 days of the assassination?
297-5633. We'll take a few phone calls. We'll hear from Vincent Bugliosi and wrap it up with Richard Lipsy, who's soaking in the words from Mr. Bugliosi. And we'll talk about what happened in Dallas on this day 50 years ago, back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Vincent Bugliosi and Richard Lipsy are with us in our final segment this hour discussing what happened on this day in Dealey Plaza, Dallas, Texas, November 22, 1963. One of the more remarkable aspects of the Kennedy assassination is that the evidence, the biggest evidence, is from a man who was a Dallas dressmaker, Abraham Sapruder. And he was interviewed by WFAA in Dallas shortly after the assassination on the night of November 22nd. Here's how Abraham Sapruder sounded on this date a half century ago.
May I have your name, please, sir?
My name is Abraham Sapruder.
Mr. Sapruder?
Sapruder, yes, sir.
Sapruder. And would you tell us your story, please, sir?
I got out and about a half hour earlier and get into a good spot to shoot some pictures. And I found a spot, one of these concrete blocks that I have down near that park near the underpass. And I got on top there. There was another girl from my office. She was right behind me. And as I was shooting, as the president was coming down from Houston Street making his turn, he was about halfway down there. I had a shot. And he slumped to the side like this. Then I had another shot or two. I couldn't say whether it was one or two. And I saw his head practically open up, all blood and everything. And I kept on shooting. That's about all. I'm just sick again.
I think that pretty well expresses the entire feelings of the whole world.
Amazingly, a Dallas dressmaker is the man who comes up with the biggest piece of evidence on that day in Dallas 50 years ago today.
Yeah, he actually filmed the assassination. There's no audio on it, though, but he filmed the assassination, yeah.
What is that piece of evidence done as far as fueling the conspiracy?
Well, that's very, very sophisticated. It calls for a long discussion. I don't think we have time to get into it, but you can tell from the film that the first shot's about 160, frame 160. Why? Because Connolly turns to his right. The FBI agents, they all turn to the right, and they look up. But there's no evidence that anyone was hit at 160. Three shots were fired. The headshot at 313 was 8 seconds after frame 160. And there's no question that he was hit at 313 because you can see the explosion to the president's head at frame 313. But it gets into several sophisticated issues on the single bullet theory, which I examine in great depth in Reclaiming History, but I, because of time limitations, I don't see how we can get into it.
Well, one thing, Vincent, I wanted to impart, and we've got two different emails about this. The president was wearing a back brace. He's obviously hit once. He's trying, it seems, to go down, but he's not able to get down, and the back brace may have cost him his life.
Absolutely. You know, he was injured very severely when his PT boat was cut in half by a Japanese destroyer in Solomon Islands during the Second World War. So he had this very stiff back brace on, and the shot that entered his, which is the second shot that was fired, but was the first shot that hit him, the upper right back, exited the front of his throat, he did not collapse in the seat as Connolly did. Connolly was hit by that same bullet, and he collapsed completely out of the line of fire. Kennedy did not collapse, probably because of the back brace, keeping his head exposed to the line of fire by Oswald in the sixth-floor window. So, as some people have said, the Japanese finally did get Kennedy in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963.
You were a man of 29 years old at that time. Do you recall the day itself?
Well, I was walking in the hall at UCLA Law School, and a clerical personnel told me that the president had been shot. I happened to be the president of my graduating class, so I took it upon myself to walk into all the classrooms and told the professor about it and announced to the students what had happened, and then the professor excused the students for the day. The entire world was shocked. The president wasn't dead at that point. Shot at 12:30, although the argument could be that he was dead on arrival when he arrived at Parkland Hospital, but there was still a pulse, and they frantically tried to resuscitate him, but he was officially declared dead at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
How do you think that changed our country?
Well, that gets into speculation, but I think very arguably it altered the course of American history. My conclusion in the book, as you know, my book is 1,650 pages with a CD of another 1,000 pages. I go into great depth on just about everything. I conclude, and I'm no authority when we get into history, only on the assassination, the facts of the assassination, but I conclude that there probably would not have been the Vietnam War whose cataclysmic consequences resonate to this very day. I'll just give you one piece of evidence because we just don't have time. But on October the 11th, which is less than 1 month before the assassination, Kennedy issued National Security Action Memorandum. It was 263. What did that provide? It provided that Kennedy wanted 1,000 American troops in Vietnam to return to this country by the end of the year. Now, this is all circumstantial, but that certainly goes in the direction that he was not of a frame of mind to escalate the war in Vietnam at that point. And my conclusion, and it's a point that's been lost to history, and there is a division of opinion, my conclusion is that Kennedy would not have gone to war in Vietnam if he had lived. And I don't have to tell you how important that is. One thing about my book, Jim, I should say, you know, I've had three number one books that got the New York Times in true crime, including Helter Skelter, the biggest-selling true crime book in publishing history. In Cold Blood is number two. And whenever I was on shows, I've been on your show for whatever the book, I never praised the book. I just told the listener what the book was about. I can't do that with Reclaiming History because I literally would be misleading people to believe that maybe it's just another one of the 1,000 books on the assassination. It very definitely is not. It's an extremely special book. Reviewer after reviewer has said that it's the definitive book on the assassination. Some have gone beyond that and called it the final word on the assassination. So I'm very proud of the book. And I have to praise it because I cannot mislead people into thinking this is just a typical book. It's not.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Vincent Pugliosi. And one of the other ironies is that 5.5 years later, when Sirhan killed Bobby Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel, one of the first people on the scene there was the gentleman we're speaking with, and you found Sirhan's car on Alexandria Street near the...
Well, actually, I didn't call it. I was trying another murder case at the time, but I got a call late at night that Sirhan's car was found parked on Alexandria Street about a block from the Ambassador Hotel, and I was asked to get a search warrant, so I had to wake up some judge in the middle of the night at his home, get a search warrant, and then I went to the car, and I remember the law enforcement was there, and my recollection is that they broke into his car with a crowbar, and I do recall that some unexpended rounds of ammunition were found on the front seat, and some books on the occult, Jim, in the back seat. So I didn't find the car. I was directed to where it was, but I did prepare the search warrant to search the car.
Well, thank you, Vincent. Good to talk with Vincent Pugliosi.
I appreciate it, Jim. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And we're back with Richard Lipsy, who's been listening and sounded like he was taking notes from you.
It was very interesting. I'm certainly glad because, you know, I get questioned all the time. You know, I don't talk to a lot of groups, but I do talk to some, and of course the questions about the conspiracy, the questions, so are you sure that there was only one shooter? So many people say bullets came from different directions there at Dealey Plaza, and I have not, I'm embarrassed to say, I have not read Reclaiming History. I would like to. It's just haven't had time. Another author, Gerald Posner, wrote a book called Case Closed, which is, to me, puts it all in perspective.
Well, I know through the years you haven't done a lot of interviews, and I've been pleased to see that you've done several print interviews, and today you're spending time with us. And Ruth Laney did a fine piece in Country Roads. George Morris did an exceptional piece in Sunday's Advocate with Richard Lipsy, who was there for the autopsy on this date in 1963. You were 24 years old at the time. After experiencing something like that, it seems that life can be a little mundane. I'm sure it's had an effect on you personally.
Well, you know, for 15 years I could not speak of this. I don't know whether I told you this earlier, but I had to sign the National Securities Act right after the autopsy, and which said I could not discuss this with anyone, my family, my wife, which I was not married at the time, for 15 years. And you forget a lot. And, you know, you put it out of your mind. And, you know, 15 years and a few days later, I go to my office one morning at 8 o'clock, and I open the door, and behind me, two gentlemen in suits get out of their automobile and walk up to me and said, "Are you Richard Lipsey?" "Yes." "Were you in the U.S. Army in 1963? "Yes." "Were you in Washington?" "Yes." "We're the attorneys for the House Committee on Assassinations, and we want to talk to you." And they came in my office, and we talked for almost 3.5 hours. And those kind of things, they end up on, you know, after, I think it was 1997 when they released a lot of information, they all end up on the Internet. So I think this may be the first live radio interview that I've ever done. Every time I talk to somebody about it, they want to challenge what I say, just like your interview just then with Mr. Bugliosi. What he says is definitive, but there are going to be people. How many did he say? There are 244 different theories and groups that are certain they're right.
Right.
So what can I say, Jim? I'm in total agreement with him, and the Warren Commission was accurate. There was a single lone shooter, and it was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, on that day, Walter Cronkite broke the news to America, but later that night, one of the best pieces was done by Edwin P. Newman of NBC, who had gone to LSU. And here's how Edwin P. Newman described what had happened on this day 50 years ago.
The lives of all of us of today have been profoundly changed. It's not yet possible to say exactly how much or in precisely which particulars, but they have been irrevocably changed. In these circumstances, I hope that I may be allowed a personal reaction, which perhaps will also be the reaction of some others. One's first feeling, of course, was that it was a dream, not real. After that came the dispiriting, hopeless feeling that it was banal, an absurdity, and that is the feeling that persists. Foreigners have been asking all day, how can you let this sort of thing happen? Well, we don't let it happen. Someone will someday have to say how a man with a high-powered rifle got into a building along the route in Dallas, but this is a country of 190 million people. Basically, it's true that if someone wants badly enough to kill the president, provided he's willing to take some risk himself, he has a very good chance of doing it. Such people are happily extremely rare. And we do not know at this moment who killed the president or why. We may say with justice that it was an act of insanity and the rest of us are sane. It has nevertheless brought us face to face with some unpleasant truths about ourselves. The main point that emerges from this day's events is that the United States is still a country of violence. Violence plays a part in our political life, and not only through assassination. We've seen that in the last 3 years and in the years before that. We are, some of us, in the habit of laughing at the Latin American nations for the way in which their governments turn over. A lot of them do turn over. Assassination, however, does not play a large part in their affairs. Latin American governments usually turn over without much killing. To pursue this point further, we are a people who worry a great deal about our image. It must be said that at this time, our image is not a very desirable one. We do not appear today as an adult country. For what happened today is not an isolated incident. There were attempts against President Roosevelt and against President Truman in our own time, three presidents before Mr. Kennedy died at the hands of assassins. So we have a nation in which emotions run high and in which conflicts are often stark. These conflicts arise from a number of sources: regional, economic, racial, religious, and ethnic. The problem is to contain those conflicts and to reduce the influence of violence and the threat of violence in our politics.
That's Edwin P. Newman, 50 years ago tonight on NBC. And Richard Lipsey, you've served our country with distinction. Today you'll be involved with some events at Louisiana State University.
Yes, today is the Cadets of the Old War School weekend at LSU. We will have a lot of very honorable retirees return to the campus today, and we will salute several past members of the LSU ROTC that graduated from LSU and went on to serve their country admirably. And we will salute those people today and tomorrow morning. And so our Cadets of the Old War School luncheon is today, and the ceremony will be tomorrow morning.
Parade grounds, right? At the parade grounds?
No, because of the weather. It's been moved into the LSU okay. Union. It is on the parade ground normally, but for the threat of the weather, we're moving inside.
And tonight, Richard Lipsey and some others will be at the Manship Theater at 7 o'clock, a showing of Parkland, and there will be a panel discussion about the Kennedy assassination. We look forward to seeing you then, and thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It Richard was Lipsey. My pleasure. Thank you, Jim. I enjoyed it.
And, of course, throughout the day on WRKF, we will hear more about what happened on this day 50 years ago. For J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.